just concluding statements about success, and I chose to have these statements under a title, Seven Conditions to Set a Goal. Because most of these people, if not all of them, had a goal. She had a goal to escape and go to Medina. She had a goal not to confine herself to the needle. She had a goal to live for her son and make him a decent human being. Anas ibn Malik, that is. The other woman had a goal to utilize her education and to benefit society. So, seven conditions to set a goal. Number one, the goal should be clear and well-defined in your mind. The goal should be ambitious. Number three, do not fear your goal, but believe that you can achieve it. Love your goal, even if it was an idea. Number four, transform your goals into steps according to a practical plan that you strive to implement. There has to be a plan. You can't say just my goal is to achieve my PhD, for example. Okay, when? In what? Which university? Who will be my supervisor, for example? So the goal shouldn't be vague, should be clear, and there should be deadlines or should be time period. And there are long-term goals, middle-term goals, and short-term. Number five, exert all your efforts to achieve your goal. All your effort. It's like pushing the wall. Push until you cannot push no further. This is ijtihad, by the way. This is what a mujtahid does in a fiqh issue. But this is indeed what a mujtahid does in everything in life. Be it family problems, be it in physics, be it in chemistry, politics, economics, that he or she cannot think further. This is ijtihad. So once you've decided your goal, exert all your efforts to achieve your goal. And incidentally, these points are inspired from the stories of the people that I have mentioned. Number six, have hope. Always be optimistic. Not to be frustrated the moment that you strike the first obstacle. Always have hope and always have ambition and hope that you are able to achieve that. And number seven, which is also inspired from number six, be persistent and patient. Be persistent and patient. So these were the conditions to set a goal. Now I'm going to introduce to you another theme, which takes us away from success into one inspiring word, and that is impact. And impact is a stronger word than effect. Let me then articulate the lenses and the paradigms of my choice for selecting my heroes that serve the word impact. Number one, the narration of Islamic history is incomplete without recognizing the role of women in its making. And the stories of my women will show you that you cannot have a proper history without their names in, because they had an impact on society. Number two, women had a tremendous impact, not just inside households, but on society at large. No way am I undermining the impact of the role of women inside the household. But here I am inclined to society. Society means the market. Society means children. Society means institutions, schools, human beings at large, not just my father, mother, daughter or son, husband or wife. But household is important. And I can change society by changing a household. So please do not misunderstand me. Number three, the impact includes domains that are usually perceived exclusive domains of men. And when I was looking for stories to do with impact, I was interested in impact. I was interested in impact, societal impact, in avenues that are stereotypically monopolized by men. So you can see I'm not selecting any story. I end up having 20 stories, but I think only three are worthy of the narrative. Number four, women of today, and that's relevant to you now. Women of today should aspire to leave a legacy of impact, even if limited, so as not to become frustrated with the stories, even if limited, on society that she lives in. I will leave this for you to decide now what sort of impact. Could be social, political, whatever, but make sure that before, may Allah give you long life, before you depart this dunya, leave a legacy, have a dream, an impact, and work on it. And your dream might be, I will produce a genius for this society. I will be another mother for Ahmed ibn Hanbal. Why not? Not in fiqh or in sharia, in anything. In medicine, in physics, in politics, in anything. But I'm going to produce to this society a genius human being, a good human being. That could be a dream, and you could work for it. What are the categories of impact? Three categories. Welfare, religious, and political. And what is fascinating to me is the political, because it hurts some men. Again, I'm looking for avenues that are stereotypically confined to men, hence the politics. Welfare, we have lots of stories. The women that participated in battlefields, in their capacity as first aid, as helpers, bringing water. And one great example is the example of this woman companion called Rufayda al-Ansariya. Rufayda is a fascinating case because she had a special tent in the mosque of Al-Rasul Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. In Masjid al-Nabawi, you go to Al-Masjid al-Nabawi, you find a tent. Who's sleeping under this tent? They will tell you, no, this is not a homeless selling the issue tent or whatever. This is a tent. This is actually a hospital. Really? Who does it belong to? It belongs to a woman called Rufayda. That is exactly was the situation in Al-Masjid al-Nabawi during the time of Rasulullah Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. And when there is any prominent companion who was injured in the battlefield, they will carry him to Rufayda's tent inside Al-Masjid al-Nabawi. She was an excellent nurse with an excellent tent. One of the famous companions was called Sa'd ibn Mu'adh. When he was injured, he died out of his injury. When he was injured, they brought him to this tent. And Rasulullah Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam knows that he was based in Rufayda's tent. And Rasulullah Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam used to visit him in Rufayda's tent. Inside this tent, of course, for all the first aid, all the medicine, etc. Rufayda is a classic example. I'm not geared towards women companions, simply because I feel that they have been exhausted and they are too famous. Let me introduce to you a woman that was engaged in welfare services that you know of, not because of her, but because of her brother. Salah al-Din. Salah al-Din al-Ayyubi. Or Saladin, the one who liberated Palestine in the Battle of Hittin. Have you heard of his sister? You should be angry at the male historians because they disguised her. But she is a fascinating woman. She is called Zumurrud. So Zumurrud is the sister of Salah al-Din. But you say to me, maybe she wasn't famous because Salah al-Din was famous because he was able to fight the Crusades and liberate Palestine. No, she fought the Crusades, but not physically, but through welfare services. Do you know what Zumurrud used to do? Zumurrud turned her house into a pharmacy that was manufacturing medicine for those who were injured in the fights against the Crusades. And painkillers and tablets and all the medicine that was known at that time was produced, manufactured, analyzed, packed, marketed in thousands from Zumurrud's house. In thousands. This is coming from Zumurrud. This is made in Zumurrud. Try painkillers. Excellent from Zumurrud. Zumurrud was the main supplier of medicine to the injured Muslim army that were fighting with Salah al-Din. Salah al-Din would not have been able to liberate Palestine without Zumurrud's effort. That's why I told you that you would have an incomplete, vague and confused, misleading picture of Islamic history if you omitted women from the jigsaw puzzle. But Zumurrud is a so kind woman that her contributions were not confined to moments of battles, but even in moments of peace, she would manufacture medicine for the orphan, for the needy, for the sick, and for the diseased. So her services were 7-11, 24 hours, 360 throughout the year. And I've put here a concluding comment. How can women be creative and think about alternatives other than war? So rather than saying war is a male domain, Yes, but within war, there are opportunities. You can teach people first aid. You can provide medicine. It's a, now, I don't want you to think in context of war and battle. I want you to think in your context that what are the opportunities to me as a girl? I might not be welcomed in a male conference or in a conference that secludes girls and puts them at the back, and all what they can see is a screen of the speaker. They have no access to the speaker because he's holy and he happens to be a male. And never will the male welcome a woman speaker unless she talks about women in Islam. Okay, this is the situation. Should you retire and surrender? Oh, what can I do? Write books, have an impact on sisters, go and speak to the brothers and change their views. I'm excluded from mosques. Okay, what can I do? Let me go and clean the toilets and the bathrooms in the mosque to show the Maulana that a sister is not just a burden that wants to pray and do nothing. She's able to cook some food on Friday. She's able to clean the... do services to society, to impose on society, to imagine that life is impossible without you. You know, no male will tell you this, but a man might not think that you are important because you have retired to his stereotype and played by the roles that he defined to you, because the roles that he defined to you are not important to him. He can live without your roles. But if you can actually, I'm not creating revolutions here, but what I'm saying, I'm creating positive thinking for the male and the female, that if you can actually tap into roles that are necessary. Look, look, she's having a tent in the middle of the mosque. Look, she's providing medicine in a context of crusades fighting and providing medicine in a context of peace. How can society live without her? You will always have ill people. So medicine is crucial. So you have to think, what does society today needs? I will be able to fill the needs of the society. And then, believe me, the male will come to you and say, sister, please do everything for us. Because without you, we can't do anything. We have to reach this level. Not because I'm feminist and this extremist Marxist feminist struggle and hating men and lesbianism. I'm sorry to say this, but no, no. He's your brother, he's your father, he's your husband. I want to help. I don't want to compete. I don't want to conflict. I want to help you. Allow me to do so. This is welfare. What about religious impact? Impact in terms of, again, services. Not through rhetoric and talks, but through real services. There are loads of examples of women who had religious services through religious institutions that provided society with services. Endowments, awqaf, waqf. Not just building mosques, but building orphanage houses and institutions and schools, teaching institutions and hospitals and clinics, not just mosques. And you know why not mosques? Because women sometimes think that, why should I build an institution that I'm not part of? Why should I build an institution that at the end of the day will employ an imam that when I come and utilize this institution, you say, sister, please go away. That's why you find in history, most of the mosques are built by male donators. And most of the orphanage houses, schools, clinics, hospitals are built by female donators. And because also they are more caring. I'm not going to give millions for people to pray. You can pray anywhere. But I'm going to give millions to rescue this child from AIDS or cancer. This is the perception. A classic example now of this welfare service from a religious perspective was the wife of Harun al-Rashid. Harun al-Rashid was an Abbasid caliph that came in the 9th Christian century and the 2nd Islamic century. Zubaydah, which is his wife, one day decided to go into a pilgrimage from Baghdad to Mecca. And during the travel, she suffered a lot because in the way there were no wells, there were no access to water, there were no hotels, guest houses, nothing that could accommodate for the travelers that were traveling from Baghdad to Mecca. The moment people reached Mecca, they were going to die out of thirst. So she decided to come out with this creative idea, that I want a water link between Baghdad and between Mecca. A water link, a well to be dug in Baghdad, and through some connections, like an underground tube, that will link the well of Baghdad into a well in Mecca. They said to her, O Zubaydah, this is impossible. This will cost millions on millions. She brought the highest engineers in her time. She said, look, you have to think of a way. I don't care. Look, this is the goal now. This is the ambition. Think of a way. I don't care. They said to her, it will cost millions of money. And she said a famous classic statement. She said, do it. Even if you have to spend in each time you dig a dinar, some contemporary historian, he said 1 dinar during her time equals $40 of today. It means that dig, even if it costs me $40 to dig once. So how many digging are you going to do from Baghdad to Mecca? Millions of digging. She said, I'm prepared. And every time the engineer comes to her the following day, he says, it's impossible. It's costing us a fortune. She says, do it, do it. Within 3-4 months, it was done. And the people of Baghdad would make dua for her the moment they do pilgrimage. I'm not sure if the well exists today in Baghdad, but the location of it is known, and it's called Ain Zubaydah, the well of Zubaydah. And from Baghdad to Mecca, not just wells, she began to build hotels, guest houses, for free. For free. And she began to build also wells, small wells that are connecting from Baghdad to Mecca. And mosques as well. She began to build mosques rather than people praying in the desert. So I'm talking about a woman that was able to make life easy for men and also pray in mosques and sit in hotels by way of accommodation. Again, talking about awqaf and endowments. Look at this quotation, which I got from a history book about the Ottoman Empire. You are aware that books of biographies, like for example, there are lots of books, Tabaqat ibn Sa'd and Al-A'im al-A'lam, etc. It's books of al-Dhahabi. If you look at most of these biographies, narrating the biographies of scholars, good people, notables in society, predominantly they were men. So someone who wants to understand the role of women in society might not find it helpful to read these biographies. How do I understand then the role of women? Go to the Ottoman Empire's records that are in the museums today and go and read the records of the courts. They're not just the divorces and the marriages. Go and look at the records that narrates and documents endowments. Al-awqaf al-khayriya. And look this statement. Ottoman charitable endowments. Waqf records show greater involvement of women than biographies alone show. Women sometimes founded nearly 40% of all endowments. And this is a significant number. I'm going just before I leave religious services, just end with one woman. To me, she's fascinating. Her name is Umm al-Baneen, or Fatima bint Muhammad. She lived in 13th century, Islamic century. She's quite recent. And for a historian to say quite recent, talk about 600-700 years. She is from Andalus. So straight away, I opened bracket and said, a good example for a European woman. This is a European woman now. Because she's from Spain. She's not an Arab. Incidentally, during my research, wallahi, I'm sorry, I tried to look for women from Pakistan, India, Mughal Empire, and there are a lot. A lot. You just go to Taj Mahal and women is involved there. Umm al-Baneen is a woman that was based in Andalus, but she then traveled and was based in Fas, in Morocco, with her family. She had a sister, and her sister was engaged in real work, etc. And I'm not going to talk about her sister, although her sister is also amazing. But I want to speak about Umm al-Baneen. What fascinates me about Umm al-Baneen is this religiosity, this angelic purity. She didn't do something that is unique. She built a mosque from her own expenses. But look at how she approached this project of building a mosque. founded a very important mosque in Fas, which is called Jami' al-Qurawiyyin. Now, Jami' al-Qurawiyyin in Morocco is like the Azhar Mosque in Egypt today. It became a very well-known center of attraction to everyone who wanted to study Islamic sciences, so it was later turned into an Islamic university. Who founded this university at the mosque level? Because usually at that time, it begins as a large mosque, and then students sleep there, and then it expands, becomes a university. This is how the story of classical universities. Al-Azhar was there, Al-Qarawiyyin was another example. The one that actually built that mosque, that later expanded into university, was Umm al-Banin. Umm al-Banin decided for two things before she engaged into that project. And it's a fascinating example of religiosity. First of all, she said, from the time and the moment that this mosque is going to be built, I'm going to be fasting. Yes, but it's going to take months and months and months. She said, I will fast on a daily basis until the mosque is done. This is number one. So basically, while the mosque is being done, she wants the angel to write her among those who are fasting. Second procedure, she said, I want to make sure that not a single stone or a brick or sand or cement or anything used to build that mosque comes from a haram source or even a suspicious source. I'm not going to rely on this company to provide me with the bricks because I'm not sure how this company makes its money. But that's not your business. But I just want this project to be as blessed as possible. So what are you going to do? Look at this creativity again. She purchased the piece of land that was next to the mosque. And she said, use all the sand and all the bricks from that land, because I know this is my land, it's halal, to manufacture the bricks and to use it to build the mosque. Historians say that, I'm not sure if you can witness it today or not, but they say that if you looked at the mosque after it has been built, you can see the land that was next to it, holes everywhere. It's very funny, and people look at it and cannot understand what's the... This is the relation between this land. This land here was purchased to be used in the building of that mosque that is just next to it. So this is what I think is a fascinating story about Umm al-Banin. And here at the end, I've put a concluding statement. I said, this is a fascinating story that shows that when woman is religious, she thinks and does wonders. All what you need for this girl is for her to believe. And the moment she believes, she can do wonders. But she is difficult to convince, that's the problem. She's stubborn. But the moment you change her, she will do more than you can think. And that's why I think that we could expect one day from women in this country more than we can expect from men. But you have to change them. Because look at what happens when women change. Look at what happens when Zubaydah decides, this is what I want to do. When Umm Kulthum, when Umm al-Banin, when Rufayda, when Zubaydah, when Zumurrud, that's what happens when they decide to do it. I want to finish off Impact with a story. It carries many messages, but I'm not going to promote or market one story at the expense of the other. All stories are dear to us. And this is another story. It's talking about a woman who is aware and who is concerned about the political affairs of her people, of her ummah. And she is trying to do the best in order to reform the status quo and the political situation. It's something that is unique. I'm talking about the sister of someone that you already know, a great Khalifa who is called Umar ibn Abdul Aziz. She is his sister. And she is called also Umm al-Banin. She is called Umm al-Banin. Umm al-Banin is like Fatima bint Abdul Malik. Her father was a ruler. Her husband is a caliph. Her brother is a caliph. So she is like Fatma bint Abdul Malik in the sense that she is surrounded by caliphs. And she comes from this elitist family and elitist background. I'm going to talk about her encounter with someone who has been perceived in Islamic history to be a great tyrant. And this person is called Al-Hajjaj. Of course, we don't want to demonize Hajjaj too much. Hajjaj is a, on some aspect, is a great personality. He was the person that led expeditions in spreading Islam to Africa. And Muhammad al-Qasim al-Thaqafi, who spread Islam into India, he did so on the orders of Al-Hajjaj. But Hajjaj has personal problems that I will need to articulate to you for you to appreciate the role that this woman did. The Umayyad dynasty is not an ideal dynasty. It had rulers that were good, such as Umar ibn al-Aziz, and it had rulers who were corrupt. And I don't want to now, it's a very hot topic this is, because of the Khawarij and the Shia and the Mu'tazila and those who supported the house of Ali. And I'm not going to engage in all that. Neither do I want to bore you. Go and pick up any book in Islamic history and you will know what I mean. I'm not interested in all that. I'm zooming now into a woman. But to appreciate what she did, I think you have to have a taste of the context that she was living in. So I have to do this very carefully without boring you. Suffice it to say that Umm al-Banin was married to Yazid. And Yazid was an unjust ruler. And Yazid, he was the caliph. And during the Umayyad period, the caliph was based in Damascus. I'm seeing people already bored. Look, in a nutshell, Islamic empires had capitals. So the capital of the Abbasid Empire was Baghdad. If you know this, this is enough. The capital of the Ottoman Empire, you know this, it's Istanbul. The capital of the Umayyad Empire was Damascus. Good? I won't say more than this. This is maybe too much. Okay, so three count. So Umm al-Banin was based in Damascus because she was the wife of Yazid, who was the caliph during the Umayyad and therefore in Damascus. Now, there are governors for the caliph. And a lot of them are corrupt governors. One of the governor is based in Baghdad. One of the governor is based in Baghdad. He's not a caliph. He's a wali, a governor. His name was Al-Hajjaj. Hajjaj has a brother who is also a governor, but not in Baghdad, in Yemen. So Al-Hajjaj is the governor of Yazid, and he is based in Baghdad. Al-Hajjaj is brutal, but I will not talk about Al-Hajjaj. I will talk first of all about his brother. His brother is called Muhammad. Muhammad is corrupt like his brother, Al-Hajjaj. So much so that he mistreats people. He extracts high taxes from them. He abuses men, women, children. People fear Muhammad ibn Yusuf al-Thaqafi. That is his full name. One day, Muhammad heard that Yazid was going to perform pilgrimage from Damascus to Mecca. And he, Muhammad, is based in Yemen, and Yemen is very close to Mecca. So he said, to show himself as a decent, loyal governor, I am going to go to Hajj this year in order to see Yazid and to assure him that things are fine, stability, security, everything is fine in the Islamic Empire, and I'm going to give him great gifts from Yemen, leather, all kind of things that Yemen is famous for. Umm al-Banin, the wife of Yazid, heard that all the gifts that Muhammad was going to bring to her husband Yazid are stolen gifts, squeezed out of the people. So basically they are of haram sources. Yazid doesn't know this. Umm al-Banin accompanied Yazid to Mecca. When you are a caliph, you have a palace wherever you go. There is a palace for you in Mecca. There is a palace for you in Baghdad, in Egypt, wherever. Umm al-Banin said to her husband, Ya Amir al-Mu'mineen, I would like to have a look at the gifts that Muhammad is going to bring to you. Of course, look at this wise woman. She's not telling him from the start there's a problem with the gifts, but she's trying to be diplomatic. So she said to him, I would like to look first at the gifts. Because he said to her, why? Why is this? These are gifts for me. Why is it important for you to look at these gifts? She said, well, I like gifts from Yemen. So he sent a messenger to Muhammad and said to him, please show the gifts that you have to Umm al-Baneen. Muhammad and al-Hajjaj know that Umm al-Baneen is the sister of Umar ibn Abdul Aziz. And Umar ibn Abdul Aziz hate both brothers. They are corrupt. So they know that Umm al-Baneen know that they are corrupt. He knows that it's not just a matter of me showing her the gifts. So he said to the messenger, tell Amir al-Mu'mineen that I love him so much that I want him to be the first to look at these gifts. He just wants to make a statement that I brought you gifts. And then he can deal with Umm al-Baneen. So the messenger informs Yazid, and Yazid goes back to Umm al-Baneen, and he says, it seems that Muhammad is unhappy with your suggestion. He wants to show me first the gifts. And here the woman speaks. And she says to him, Ya Amir al-Mu'mineen, to be honest, I don't care less about the gifts. He said, then why did you want to look at them? She said to him, because I heard, Ya Amir al-Mu'mineen, that they are from haram sources. And he said to her, can you prove it? She said, no, but people in Yemen came personally reporting to me that Muhammad have jailed, have killed, have tortured people in order to generate these gifts. Incidentally, gifts here is not a watch or a red flower. No, we are talking about camels full of jewelry, full of things coming especially from Yemen in thousands of dollars, to understand what we are talking about. Otherwise, you will not be fussy about a stolen pen or whatever. Straight away, Yazid, to prove to his wife that he's a decent husband and also to make a point that he's a just ruler, he actually went to Muhammad, met him in Mecca, and said, Ya Muhammad, I heard that you've stolen these gifts. And Muhammad said, no, Ya Amir al-Mu'mineen, wallahi, they are not stolen. But he could tell that it's your wife who told you that they are stolen. Said, wallahi, Ya Amir al-Mu'mineen, they are not stolen. He said, Ya Muhammad, I want you to go and make tawaf around the Kaaba. And while you are making tawaf, swear to me, by Allah, 50 times that they are not stolen. So he said, okay, Ya Amir al-Mu'mineen, I will do that. And he went and made tawaf. And wallahi al-azim, uqsimu billahi al-azim, 50 times that they are not stolen. Historians tell us that a month after that, Muhammad al-Thaqafi died. Now, I don't want to insinuate that there was a connection between him and his death, this incident. But the point I want to make to you is that look at a woman who is identified by Orientalists as belonging to the harem. So she is protected in a castle or in a palace, yet she is aware of everything that is taking place as far as Yemen. I don't want you to know everything that is taking place outside the United Kingdom, but please, when you do know about things in the United Kingdom that you think you can change and reform, do it. I'm not asking you to know everything about the politics of Yemen, but this is an outstanding lady, married to an outstanding man, occupying an outstanding position, therefore she has to have outstanding ambitions and aspirations. Actually, this is not what is fascinating in that story. What is fascinating in that story is the encounter now with the big man, with Al-Hajjaj. You have to appreciate who is Al-Hajjaj. You have to understand who is Al-Hajjaj. For you then to appreciate an encounter between Umm al-Baneen and Al-Hajjaj. Al-Hajjaj is an abnormal character. If he looks at you and he dislikes your haircut, he will chop your head off. They said that when Al-Hajjaj passed away, they opened the prisons of Baghdad, and there were over 80,000 Muslim prisoners in his jail. 30,000 of them were women. That is other than those who died in prison. Al-Hajjaj could kill any scholar of his time. however popular that scholar is. Whenever someone mentions the word of Al-Hajjaj, it's like when you say to a Jewish man during the Holocaust, Hitler or Nazism. I'm trying to dramatize to you who was Al-Hajjaj. Of course, you have to understand something. Why was he brutal? Because the center of opposition against the Umayyad Empire was actually emerging from Baghdad. Who are the center of opposition? Both the Shia and the Khawarij. They were located in Kufa and in Basra. It's logical, therefore, that if you want to crush this opposition, to have someone who's brutal. And he was indeed a good choice. When he became the governor, he entered into the mosque of Baghdad. And he began his khutbah, not Jum'ah khutbah, but the inauguration khutbah for his rule. He stood and said, Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Wa alaykum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And the first thing he said, I'm witnessing lots of long necks that I think it's now high time for them to be chopped off. And he's speaking to the musallin, and everyone is shivering, making a statement, that's me. That's how I will be dealing with you. So he killed a lot. He killed a young companion called Abdullah ibn Zubayr, who actually revolted against the Umayyad Caliphate. Do you understand now who we are talking about? He has no Sahaba, no Tabi'i. He has no red line. He can kill anyone if he sees it in service of the security of the state. Now let's zoom into this encounter between Umm al-Banin and Al-Hajjaj. Al-Hajjaj once traveled from Baghdad to go and meet Yazid in Damascus. So he entered while he was dressing all in iron and this dress that usually a warrior wears when he is in war, okay, and covering his face. And he went with Yazid and sat with him and chatted with him. And Yazid said, okay, how's Baghdad? How's the situation? How's the Khawarij? How's the Shia? Everything is fine. Everything is okay. Umm al-Banin is watching and have asked one of the servants to go and check on her husband. Who is sitting with my husband? The woman came, the servant came. She said, it's someone who is covering himself. I don't know who he is. So Umm al-Banin said, I am worried. He's dressed in a warrior's dress. I'm worried about Yazid. So go and ask Yazid, who is this man? Just at least let me know. The poor woman goes again to Yazid and says, Ya Amir al-Mu'mineen, your wife is asking, who is this person? And Yazid then says to her, this is Al-Hajjaj. He came all the way, poor man, from Baghdad to see me. And this poor servant comes again to Umm al-Banin and says, this is Al-Hajjaj. Then she says to the servant, go and tell Yazid that if he was sitting with Azrael, the angel that is responsible for taking your soul, I would feel more safer than you sitting with this bloodshedder, Al-Hajjaj. So she went and she whispered to the ears of Yazid and then she left. Yazid laughed and said to Al-Hajjaj, Hajjaj, do you know what she just said to me? He said, what? He said to him, my wife is so worried about you sitting with me. She thinks that Azrael is even better than you. And Hajjaj, this is the caliph and this is his wife. What can you do? If she was your wife, you would beat her or you would smack her or you would kill her. Simple as that. But she is the wife of thee, so you better be careful. The most he could do was to give him a private advice. After the girl left, he said to him, Ya Amir al-Mu'mineen, I would like to give you an advice. I would like you not to be friendly with women, not to chat to them, not to talk to them, not to smile at them. Those women, the more you become friendly with them, they become so bold and they begin to interfere in everything. The point he's trying to make is that you have to be formal and official. These sort of advices that some brothers give to some brothers when they are married, first night, do this, do that. Of course, he does this the first night, but the second night, he's ready to accept anything. So this is what Yazid listened from Al-Hajjaj. In the night, in the bedroom, he told Umm al-Banin about every single word that Hajjaj told him. I said, you know what Hajjaj told me? He said to me, don't be friendly with women. Women are this, women are that. Of course, I didn't translate what Hajjaj said to you. It's in Arabic because you will be offended. But he said a few good things about women. دَعَنْكَ مُفَاكَاتِ النِّسَاءِ بِزُغْرَفِ وَلَا تُطْلُعِ And don't tell them any secrets. Don't tell them your bank account or any. No, he didn't say that. He was telling him, don't tell them any secrets or any private things and be formal and serious with them. Umm al-Baneen heard everything and then said to him, Ya Amir al-Mu'mineen, I would like you to arrange for a meeting between me and al-Hajjaj. He said, why? She said, I just want to say salam to him. The following day, Hajjaj is packing to leave to Baghdad. Amir al-Mu'mineen says, wait for a while. Just a few minutes. He said, yes, khair ya Amir al-Mu'mineen. He said to him, my wife wants to say salam to you. Now Hajjaj knows Umm al-Baneen very well. He knows that she is the sister of Umar al-Aziz. Umar ibn Abdul Aziz was the greatest lobbyer for the sacking of al-Hajjaj. And the first thing Umar al-Aziz did when he came to be the caliph, he sacked al-Hajjaj. So they hate the guts of each other. And of course, the sister as well. He said, Ya Amir al-Mu'mineen, I am busy, etc. He said, no, no, it won't take a few minutes. She just wants to say salam. And I want you to imagine this meeting between a humble woman, a religious woman, that I did not talk to you, by the way, about her religiosity. Suffice it to say that she used to fast in the day and make tahajjud in the night. But I'm not going to introduce her religiosity because if I wanted, it would be under connect, not under impact. He said, okay, fine. Now, this meeting was intended for nothing other than to humiliate al-Hajjaj. Every bit in the process of that meeting has to mean big humiliation. So from the beginning, she said to the servants, when al-Hajjaj comes to meet me, of course she is going to meet him but behind the veil, when he comes, tell me. They came to her and said, Hajjaj has arrived. And then she says to them, leave him for a couple of hours, waiting. And this, for a man, is humiliating. When you have a date or whatever, and 5 o'clock, and she comes or he comes at 7, this is a humiliation, unless you are desperate. Anyway, so he waited and waited and waited. More than a couple of hours, 3 hours, and cannot leave. He cannot leave, the wife of the caliph. Then a voice came from behind the veil. I cannot translate the entire dialogue, the entire lecture. But to me, this is like a cold shower on a freezing day on the head of al-Hajjaj or even on the head of any human being. It's so eloquent, it's so powerful, it's so insulting. It is when a woman is angry and expressing her anger and she doesn't care who you are. First of all, a very beautiful introduction. She says to him, who do you think you are? Who do you think you are? Do you think that you are that strong and powerful? Aren't you ashamed of yourself? Aren't you this governor who killed this great companion, Abdullah ibn Zubayr? The one who is related to al-Rasul sallallahu alayhi wa sallam? As-Sawwam al-Qawwam, the one who prays in the night and fasts in the day? Aren't you ashamed of killing this man who was the son of Asma bint Abu Bakr, that in Nitaqain, who is the sister of Aisha, who is the wife of Rasulullah? Who do you think you are? How come you are proud and wearing this stupid dress of yours? Aren't you ashamed of actually killing Abdullah ibn Zubayr, the first Muslim baby who was born in Medina? Abdullah ibn Zubayr is famous for that. He is the first baby, Muslim baby, to be born in Medina. Are you proud of all this? And then she says, you say to my husband not to speak to women nicely, not to joke with women, not to smile at women. Do you know who are women? And this is my point now. Do you know who are we? Do you know your salary that you receive on a monthly basis, your high salary for imprisoning people and killing people? Do you know this salary? Where is it coming from? It's coming from the zakat and the tax of the gold that the Khalifa takes from us, O women, to provide for your salary. If we did not exist, if we were to be humiliated as you are suggesting, you will die out of hunger and your salary will be cut. So you have to understand and respect what you are talking about. And you have to be aware of what you are talking about. And wallahi, if it was not because of the gold of these women, you would be less than a fly. Now this is a strong one, I think. But Al-Hajjaj took it. Now he took it, not because she's a woman. He took it because she is the wife of the Khalifa. But if I read lots of conversations between normal people and Al-Hajjaj, usually he doesn't wait all that time for you to say you're a fly and you're a bug. No, he will kill you straight away. The fact that she's talking and talking and talking means that he's crippled. He can't do anything. And it's fascinating that he's crippled, because we would not have been aware of this eloquence unless he has allowed her to actually articulate these ideas. Then she moves into another topic, three topics. So first she talks about Abdullah ibn Zubayr. Second, she talks about women. And now she talks about a specific case of women. Brothers and sisters, the leader of the Khawarij that was resisting Al-Hajjaj was called Al-Dhahhak. He had a wife, and his wife is called Ghazala. Now, Ghazala is a warrior like Al-Dhahhak against Al-Hajjaj. They were leading the Khawarij army against Al-Hajjaj. Of course, they were centered in Basra, centered all over the place. They would hit and run. They would plant a bomb here and run. They were on the run, on the move. They were everywhere. They say that Hajjaj, the only woman he feared was Ghazala, because she would come into Kufa in the night, burn houses, attack people and followers of Hajjaj, and leave. And they would wake up the following night. Who did this? It's Ghazala. So Ghazala was the name that when you say it to Hajjaj, he shivers. He never saw Ghazala, but he heard about her. Ummul Baneen is aware of all that. She said to him, "Who do you think you are? You think you are very powerful? You think you're very brave? You think women are weak? What about Ghazala? What about Ghazala that makes you shiver?" Ghazala engaged in 5 battles against Al-Hajjaj and won them all. And she was fighting against Al-Hajjaj with her husband, Al-Dhahhak. Al-Dhahhak was 75 years old. And she was also fighting with her mother-in-law against Al-Hajjaj. And her mother was also in her 70s. So Al-Dhahhak died. Ghazala later was killed. And her mother-in-law was killed with her on that day by the people of Al-Hajjaj. And only then was Al-Hajjaj felt that he was relieved when Ghazala was killed. So she says to him, "You think you are brave enough? You think you are heroic enough? What about Ghazala? Isn't she a woman? And isn't she someone that you fear? So don't tell me that you are powerful. You are only powerful on those who are freaks, on those who are weak. But when a woman such as Ghazala fights you, you shiver. Now you can go in peace to Baghdad." He went, sweating, shivering, and he said to Yazid, Amir al-Mu'mineen, "Ya Amir," and he said to him, "Did she say salam to you?" He said, "Ya Amir al-Mu'mineen." She continued to speak and speak and speak. And I said to myself, and this is the first time that this idea came to me, I wished that while she was speaking, the earth split into two, swallowed me, and then shut again. For him now to say that means that this is power. This is impact. I'm not sure to what extent Al-Hajjaj changed after that, but enough, and it was sufficient for him at least to hear these words, that a lot of scholars, a lot of companions, a lot of women, a lot of children in prison were unable to say it to him in his face. A woman was able to do that, and very eloquently and very successfully. Now, I don't want you to be like Ghazala. I don't want you to be like Umm al-Baneen, go 10 down street, knock the door. You will be waiting for a couple of hours, not him. I don't want you to do that. But I want you to think along the same line as Umm al-Baneen. Petition, demonstrations, rallies, making a point about how you feel and what you feel. أقول قولي هذا وأستغفر الله لي ولكم فاستغفروه إنه الغفور الرحيم.